Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On Sojourner Truth, we have been bringing regular coverage as we can on the devastation of the hurricanes, as well as the recent earthquakes in Mexico. We continue that coverage today. In the United States, we are now getting no information from mainstream media or even U.S.-based alternative media about the devastating impact of Hurricanes Maria and Irma on the islands of St. Croix, St. John, and St. Thomas, all three part of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Neither are we getting any information on non-U.S. territories, including the island nation of Dominica, where at least 27 people were killed. Today, we get an update on the region from Dobrin Omard, who is from Antigua and Barbuda. Barbuda was totally destroyed and all residents evacuated to its sister island in Antigua. Dobrin is based in Antigua. He is a writer. He's known throughout the region for his cultural work and expertise, and he is a member of the Barbuda Antigua Reparations Commission. And Donald Trump unveiled his tax plan. It is estimated to cost at least $2.2 trillion over a decade in lost revenue for the government. The plan is short on details, and as of yet, we have no idea where the money will come from or what social programs may be slashed to pay for Trump's tax plan. Who will benefit? Who will lose? What are the few details we know about it, and how will it impact all of us? Josh Bivens, Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute, breaks it down for us. For this week's Earth Watch, we speak with documentary filmmaker Lynn Goldfarb, currently working on a film about the poisoned waters in the remote Peruvian Amazon and on indigenous communities taking on big oil in a federal court in California. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Trump administration reversed course today and said it will suspend federal rules that have barred transportation of hurricane relief to Puerto Rico on foreign ships. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said on Twitter that President Trump has authorized a waiver of the Jones Act. She said Trump was responding to a request from the governor of Puerto Rico. Republicans and Democrats have pushed Trump to waive the act, saying it could help get desperately needed supplies delivered to the island more quickly and at less cost. New York Democrat Nydia Velazquez led a group of dozens of House Democrats urging the Trump administration to further deploy the Defense Department for additional support to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Their letter said millions of U.S. citizens are stranded in remote areas without basic necessities. Velazquez spoke on the House floor, criticizing the Trump administration and calling on lawmakers to provide additional financial aid.
Sadly, the response by the administration has been bumbling, inexcusably weak, and inadequate. In order to truly help the many victims affected by the hurricanes, Congress needs to start by providing the economic support required to recover.
The letter drafted by Velazquez says substantial ground and air logistical support is required to get aid to the islands, rescue stranded citizens, provide them with supplies, and assist with the restoration of power and telecommunications infrastructure. President Donald Trump has unveiled his tax proposal, a plan he claimed will help the poor and middle class, boosting jobs, workers, families, and businesses.
And someday, many years from now, our children and our grandchildren will remember this moment in history as the time when ordinary Americans took control of their destiny and chose a future of American patriotism, prosperity, and pride.
The Trump plan would cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. Many top corporations already use complicated tax dodges to pay even less than that or no taxes at all. The plan would collapse tax brackets and provide major benefits to the wealthy, such as doing away with the estate and alternative minimum taxes. It would double the standard deduction to $12,000 for individuals, $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. The skimpy six-page plan lacked many details. Democrats like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer were quick to pounce.
Under this plan, the wealthiest Americans and wealthiest corporations make out like bandits, while middle-class Americans are left holding the bag.
In a statement, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders called the plan morally repugnant and bad economic policy. Sanders made income inequality a central focus of his presidential campaign. He said the Trump tax cut plan would deliver hundreds of billions in tax breaks to the wealthy and most profitable corporations. The Trump administration is defending its decision to slash the number of refugees allowed into the United States to 45,000 next year, despite the dissent of global humanitarian groups calling that number far too low. Trump is expected to announce the 45,000 cap in coming days. It reflects the maximum number the U.S. will admit during the fiscal year that starts Sunday, although the actual number allowed could be far lower. In 2016, the last full year of the Obama administration, the U.S. welcomed 85,000 refugees. Obama had pledged to take in 110,000. The acting head of the Department of Homeland Security is refusing to say whether her agency will turn over personal information of DACA recipients to immigration agents. California Senator Kamala Harris pressed Elaine Duke on the issue at a Senate hearing yesterday. Harris said the young people brought to this country as children who successfully applied for DACA protections from deportation are terrified.
They are terrified. They were told by your agency that if they submitted this comprehensive information about their background and their status to apply for DACA, that that information would not be shared with ICE. I've asked you, I asked the former secretary, are you willing to keep America's promise to these young people and not share their information with ICE? Can you answer that question finally? It has not been answered the many times I've asked.
I think I can't unequivocally promise that, no, but I do know.
So
that
we will not keep our promise to these children and these young people?
I'm not familiar with the promise that was made to these children.
Senator Harris waived a document at the hearing which she said contained the Obama-era federal promise to DACA recipients. She extracted a vow from Duke that she would deliver an answer. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and today we'd like to start off with our weekly Earth Watch, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Lynn Goldfarb. She is an award-winning independent filmmaker with 19 documentaries broadcast on PBS and major cable networks. She specializes in historical and social issue documentaries, and she began her filmmaking career producing the Academy Award-nominated documentary With Babies and Banners, Story of the Women's Emergency Brigade. Her films range from Danger, Kids at Work, to Bridging the Divide, Tom Bradley and the Politics of Race. She is now working on Amazonia Lot 1AB with her director and producer, Lynn Goldfarb. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Lynn, give us some background here. What is going on? I mean, your film deals with these poison waters in a remote part of the Peruvian Amazon. What's gone on there? And by big oil, are there specific companies, U.S.-based companies, international companies? What's involved? What happened?
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I just want to clarify that this film, I am producing a documentary with Nicole Carson, who is directing the film, and she is currently in the Amazon filming.
Okay.
Otherwise, she would have been on this call with us. It's a film that she's been working on for many years. So currently in this remote corner of the Amazon, she is filming. The indigenous people there, led by the Achuar community, have been protesting for several weeks. And the airport has been taken over. Oil fields have been taken over. Right now, they are the only reporters and or film crews in the area reporting this. And the reason why the tribes in the area are protesting is that they want to exercise their legal right to free, prior, and informed consent. In 2011, the Peruvian government passed legislation granting indigenous people free, prior, and informed consent before any decisions were made about their land, water, and development. The Peruvian government is not honoring the legislation that they passed. And right now, they are licensing a 30-year contract to a Canadian oil company to granting them the right to drill oil, in their land and water. And that's what they're protesting. The company is Frontera Energy Corporation. They're a Canadian company. The companies that have been there throughout the years have been, foreign companies. Beginning in our story is when Occidental Petroleum started drilling there in 1971. Amazonia Lot 1AB covers this story and covers the fact that in 2007 and 2010, the Achuar people took Occidental Petroleum to court in California, and with this kind of an incredible situation. And they won, but the government has not honored, the agreements that were made from 2010 onward.
Right. So so they are taking, given that the government hasn't implemented basically the victory,
mm-hmm.
What are the next steps, as far as you know, that the indigenous people are taking?
I just got a call last night from Nicole from the Amazon. Calls are hard to make, and I was able to get a call from her. She said this morning, well, first of all, they have been filming there for the last several days. The airport has been taken over, and the oil fields have been taken over. It took them 3 days by boat from Iquitos in Peru to get to this area where Achoas, where the Achuar people live. So with the airports being taken over, the only way you can get there is by boat. Today, this morning, actually, as we speak, there is a meeting. The Peruvian government ministers are flying out, and they're opening the airport for them. They're flying out to have a meeting with the four tribal leaders, and we don't know what's going to happen. The people are skeptical. They say, negotiation has happened before. They've been promised things that have never, actually come to fruition. But the meeting is happening this morning.
Right. So this discussion here is very timely. And we know where it seems as though every corner of the planet, you find indigenous people really at the front lines and leading the charge against governments in some cases, as well as multinational corporations defending Mother Earth. Now, how much support, though, are you getting? I mean, for a project like this, for a film like this, what are you facing there? I see you've got a Kickstarter page.
Right.
That's one reason I'm asking.
Yeah, you know, it's very challenging. You know, there are, well, I mean, first of all, at this moment in time, there are so many environmental disasters and catastrophes that we've witnessed, you know, and, but this is, you know, one thing of our rivers are if the Amazon River is polluted by oil and there are oil spills, then that affects our very ecosystem as well. We have a Kickstarter campaign for this film. It is called Amazonia Lot 1AB. We are at the very end of the, towards the end of the campaign, we have 32 hours to go. And so yeah. We had a goal of 35,000. We've raised 30,000. So we're very close. But certainly, if and you know, this is a film that needs to be supported by people who believe in the you know the rights of Indigenous people.
So how can people
in our land?
Where can people go? What should they do if they want to support this?
So they should go to Quick Kickstarter, and they should you know write in Amazonia AMAZONIA Lot 1AB.
Okay,
and they can contribute to our campaign.
Right, that's Amazonia Lot 1AB, and we'll put that on our social media as well. And just finally here, Lynn, here you have Indigenous people really going after the huge fossil fuel industry. At the same time, you see regions, this takes us into our next segment, like the small islands in the Caribbean, paying such a heavy price for global warming. So all of these things are interconnected. Aren't they? I think
they're all interconnected, and you know the reason why you know the story that we're working on, you know, Amazonia Lot 1AB is so important, is that it is a case where people are fighting back, and they've gained you know some victories, but you know it's a you know the story is a thriller of you know deception and you know success and. And it really is emblematic of, you know, what the kind of struggles that are happening and what we need to be doing. We're all connected, whether it's Standing Rock, whether it's the Caribbean, whether it's the Amazon, and we need to learn from each other. And I think the film will show a story and tell a story that hasn't been seen from the point of view of the people that have been involved in this struggle.
Well, Lynn Goldfarb, thank you so very much for your work and for taking the time to join us. Our best to your colleague on the ground now filming in Peru. And we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. They partner with us for our weekly Earth Watch. Lynn Goldfarb, thank you.
And thank you for the great work you're doing. Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, the island nation of Dominica was the first to feel the fury of Hurricane Maria. The island took a direct hit at the hurricane's Category 5 strength with winds at 160 miles per hour. Dominica is based in the Caribbean with a population of approximately 72,000 people. It is mountainous with rainforests and beautiful, was referred to as a Garden of Eden, but the island was devastated, its trees destroyed, its rainforest destroyed, mudslides all over the island, its agriculture destroyed entirely. Thus far, we know of 27 deaths. Hurricane Maria wasn't the only hurricane, as we know, to hit the Caribbean region. Prior to that, there was Hurricane Irma. We saw the destruction, quoting the foreign delegate from St. Kitts to the United Nations. He says, "We are faced with a tragic destruction of life, property, and infrastructure in Antigua and Barbuda, Anguilla, St. Bartholomew, St. Martin, the British Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Cuba, the Turks and Caicos Islands, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Guadeloupe, and Dominica." And I wanted to quote him because so many of these island nations are not mentioned at all in mainstream media. And on the nation of Antigua and Barbuda, they form a nation together. Barbuda was entirely destroyed, and everyone had to be evacuated from that island nation for the first time in 300 years. No human beings living on Barbuda. It's a 300-year civilization. So what I would like to do now, the UN General Assembly had been meeting recently, and I want to play just a short clip now from the Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Dominica, the Honorable Roosevelt Skerrit.
We take this opportunity to express our condolences to our brothers and sisters in Antigua and Barbuda, Anguilla, Cuba, St. Martin, St. Thomas, the British Virgin Islands, the Turks and Caicos Islands, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic, and also to those who have suffered losses in our host country, the United States, in Texas and Florida. And to our brothers and sisters in Mexico, we stand in prayerful solidarity after the catastrophic earthquake this past week. Mr. President, warmer air and sea temperatures have permanently altered the climate between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. Heat is the fuel that takes ordinary storms, storms we could normally muster or master in our sleep, and supercharges them into a devastating force. In the past, we would prepare for one heavy storm a year. Now, thousands of storms form on a breeze in the mid-Atlantic and line up to pound us with maximum force and fury. Before this century, no other generation had seen more than one Category 5 hurricane in their lifetime. In this century, this has happened twice, and notably, it has happened in the space of just 2 weeks. And may I add, Mr. President, that we are only midway into this year's hurricane season. In the case of Dominica, it has been only 2 years since we lost lives and endured substantial physical and infrastructural damage from the ravages of floods and mudslides of Tropical Storm Erica. Mr. President, to deny climate change is to procrastinate while the earth sinks. It is to deny a truth we have just lived. It is to mock thousands of my compatriots who, in a few hours, without a roof over their heads, will watch the night descend on Dominica in fear of sudden mudslides and what the next hurricane may bring. We as a country and as a region did not start this war against nature. We did not provoke it. The war has come to us.
And the Prime Minister further went on to say about his island nation of Dominica, quote, "We dug graves today in Dominica. We buried loved ones yesterday. And I'm sure that as I return home tomorrow, we shall discover additional fatalities as a consequence of this encounter. Our homes are flattened, our buildings roofless, our water pipes smashed, and road infrastructure destroyed. Our hospital is without power, and schools have disappeared beneath the rubble. Our crops are uprooted. Where there was green, there is now only dust and dirt. The desolation is beyond imagination." I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Dobreen Omard. He is based in Antigua from the island nation of Antigua and Barbuda. He is an author, a playwright, director and producer of theater and music. He's a newspaper and magazine columnist. He's a speaker. And I mentioned earlier that he's also involved with the Barbuda Antigua Reparations Commission. And Dobreen, correct me if that is not right, but welcome back, Dobreen.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me. And yes, you're quite right. I chair the Antigua and Barbuda Reparations Support Commission, which is a member of the Caribbean Reparations Commission.
Right, right. You're the chair. Okay. Very good there. Now, you know, I know your heart is breaking, as of all of us from the region, and I have been so devastated that in the United States there is absolutely no coverage about what is going on in Dominica. There was some initially. Of course, the coverage now focuses on Puerto Rico, and I'd like to say that there is some good news, well, a bit. Puerto Rico, of course, is a humanitarian disaster, but the Jones Act that had required all goods shipped between the U.S. ports be carried by ships built by Americans and operated by Americans. Under that law, foreign vessels that enter Puerto Rico are subject to taxes, fees, and tariffs, and it was slowing down other countries, Venezuela and others, that wanted to quickly get aid into Puerto Rico. And the Trump administration initially had explained that his not waiving the Jones Act, well, was like people in the shipping industry didn't want it waived, right? But under tremendous pressure, I'm glad to report that as of this morning, the administration has now waived the Jones Act. And yesterday we covered Puerto Rico, and we will be continuing to cover that. But Dobreen, today we really want to focus on the region that right now is getting no coverage whatsoever. I mentioned a little bit about what was going on Dominica, but have you heard anything about what about St. Croix? We heard nothing about St. Croix and the humanitarian crisis there.
Yes. No news out of St. Croix has not been strong for us here either. We're depending in most instances on social media messages, and we haven't yet managed to really establish, you know, the extent of the damage in St. Croix. A lot of that social media has been really focused on individuals, on the well-being of individuals, you know. But the overall damage, et cetera, I mean, to homes and properties and crops, et cetera, no, we haven't heard much about St. Croix at all here.
Well, that is really worrying, though, because that means the place is really just smashed up. I've been trying to get through to St. Croix, worrying about some people there on the ground and can't get through by phone. I know you have tried as well. So, and you're based in the region, and you're not getting much information on St. Croix. It's really scary.
Yes, it is. A couple of other things are happening with instances like this, you know, in terms of the beginning to understand the extent of the Caribbean family. It's like talking to someone whose father is from Barbuda and whose mother is from Dominica here in Antigua. Or, you know, talking to the Dominican here who is worrying about home property in Dominica and hasn't heard from a sister in St. Croix and a brother in Tortola for the last couple of weeks. And this, I think this sort of deepening of the understanding of the regional family that we live in here in this region should help to propel, you know, the sort of better communications between us.
Yeah, it's just something. And what people, you know, I'm trying to get across to folks here. We saw the devastation, of course, in Mexico with the earthquake and the tremendous cooperation of just grassroots people basically going back to their indigenous roots of a collectivity and really working together, helping each other out. Hurricane Harvey, of course, in Houston and in Florida. Now, Puerto Rico, a growing disaster. There's fear that The main loss of life in Puerto Rico will not be from the hurricane itself, which did devastate the island, but the lack of resources, the lack of food, the lack of water, the lack of medical care. And they are U.S. territory. Of course, the U.S. Virgin Islands are also U.S. territory. But there has been a difference with the way the U.S. has dealt, the administration here has dealt with Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. But when it comes to places like Dominica and Barbuda, there is no big United States, right? They're not U.S. territories to come in. So people really don't realize that the devastation of these islands, I mean, these island nations are really starting from scratch. So who do you depend on, you know, to come in and help? Dobreen, I don't know what discussions have been happening there.
Oh, the discussions are ongoing. I think when we sit back and look at the regional destruction, yes, we can focus on, you know, on the individual nations. But when you look at the extent of the regional destruction across all those islands, nations, territories, colonies that you mentioned at the top of the program, I think we're really looking at what could perhaps constitute maybe an international disaster. I think the collective damage, physically, culturally, you know, psychologically, across this region, I don't think we've really begun to understand the extent of it. We have seen some response. We have seen some international response, you know, beyond the sort of friendly territories, the US, UK, Europe, certainly from China. In the region, we've been hearing from, well, Cuba, very, very early. Cuba and Venezuela.
And Cuba was hit. Very early. Cuba was hit, but still they were sending aid?
And this is the other thing, and it's happening in all of the territories. Antigua sent aid to Dominica when Dominica had pledged to send aid to Antigua after Irma. Guadeloupe is hit, is sending aid to Dominica. That is going on. That even at not even, I should say, that political leadership itself, I think, is demonstrating, and the idea that our survival here is regional. It's a regional responsibility. The corporation, I mean, Intra-Caribbean Corporation, I think has been excellent, you know, delivery of food and water and provision of security. There's been out of Trinidad, out of Jamaica, provision of security services, you know, things like helicopters, equipment, badges, or, you know, those sorts of things are going on in terms of attempting to aid, certainly, Dominica and Barbuda situations, at least in the OECS. We see, in terms of services, we see the offer from nations to, you know, that I will accommodate your school children or school places of specialized health services. And I think importantly too, one of the positives that I'm living with is this unified message, I think, that came out of the Caribbean to the world about the issues of climate change and the need for revision of the way the whole international aid system and the whole international financial systems are set up, because the way they are set up are contributing to our inability to prepare properly for disasters of this sort. I think we've seen that. I mean, at that level, I think at organizational levels across the region too, and the international agencies they are in. You know, the UN agencies in PAHO, WHO, Well, certainly the regional ones, CARICOM, OECS, all operational right now.
Right, and I saw that CARICOM, which is an organization involving the English-speaking Caribbean states, I think Haiti is part of it as well, were complaining about the World Bank, I think, saying, well, these islands are now categorized as quote-unquote middle class, and therefore they're not eligible for concessionary financing, which seems absolutely ridiculous because you have entire societies basically that are destroyed. I mean, if you look at a place like Saint Martin, okay, so dependent on tourism on both the French and the Dutch side. That place is a mess. Yeah. I've heard nothing about Saint Martin even mentioned on the lips of any newscasters here in the United States recently. And then you have a place like Dominica that wasn't entirely dependent on tourism in a way Saint Martin was, but dependent on agriculture. But now that agriculture is destroyed. So what the heck are they talking about these islands not eligible for aid, and also this debt that they're trying to extract right from these islands, this so-called third world debt, which really should just be eliminated. Dobrin, your thoughts on this?
Oh, certainly. And I saw prime ministers generally from the Caribbean and the international fora have been very, very strong about this arbitrary application of GDP figures to determine whether a country, you know, is eligible for concession loans out of an internationally financed organization. This has been a discussion that has been going on for some time now. But it is a discussion that's going on at technical levels, technical financial levels between the central banks here and the banks there. But I think this whole issue, the damage that we are experiencing in this disaster, will bring that type of argument to the fore a bit stronger. That the guidelines for concessionary loans are fairly arbitrary and should not be applied as to small countries where two or three people, two or three large factories, two or three large enterprises can influence GDP figures in a positive way that's not reflected at all in the living conditions of the majority of people in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I know when I visit my island nation of Barbados, especially, but not only once you get off what we call the main road, you know, go in my father's village, for example, and you go off the main road and you see some of the chattel houses and whatnot leaning like they were, you know, when I left the island so many years ago. But I want to also tie this in because this fight over international aid and the right now of the Caribbean region to get this aid from the World Bank. And, you know, people think that it's charity. Excuse me, from my perspective, it is not charity. And I want to talk with you a little bit about that, Dobrin, given your work on the Reparations Commission, because historically, we know that the English-speaking Caribbean populated by people that the British brought over as people who were enslaved to enrich themselves. And then when we fought for following the Haitian Revolution and the pressure of the Haitian Revolution, the abolition of slavery in the United States, in the Caribbean region, the British Parliament paid reparations to the slave owners. But people who were enslaved got absolutely nothing. So you have this wealth created by those of us who were enslaved, by our ancestors, right? And then you have the British Parliament paying money to the slave masters, but not to those enslaved. And now when our countries are destroyed, not because we were creating global warming, but because of actions of people like the United States and Europe, and we're paying the first price of it, Barbuda being a stark example, they have the nerve to talk about this. I'm seeing this tied in with the demand for reparations, frankly.
Oh, certainly, certainly. There are two issues, I think, that we can address immediately. The first one is relates to this whole question of aid. One of the reasons why this region, Caribbean region, is one of the most indebted regions in the world. I think four or five of our countries, in terms of population GDP figures, four or five of our countries appear on the top 10 list of indebted nations across the world.
Oh, my goodness.
Basically, two reasons for that. One is the ideas, I think, that you floated in terms of who was paid reparations in 1834, that period, the abolition of slavery. They were paid. And there has been since then an extreme difficulty for African people in this region to raise wealth. Yes, we do have rich people. We have rich people over this region. But that wealth that sits within a society, that helps it to be able to react to situations like this, the disaster we're facing, is not there. And we're saying that this is a result of enslavement of African people here and the colonialism that was imposed on us for 100 years after that. That is at one level. The whole question of the debt, we say that it is because, again, of the conditions that we came out of colonialism in, that we have been forced, I think, as a people and our governments understanding the value of education and health, for example, have been forced into debt to provide the services that are required of our people in this international world. And so the debt, again, the debt is entered in order to react to the remnants of colonialism.
Yeah, this debt, of course, of these multinational institutions, right, controlled by the U.S. and Europe.
That's correct. That's correct, you see. And so it is part of the struggle. It is part, and perhaps right now the issue of reparations is one that must come to the fore a lot stronger, because we must look at this as a Caribbean disaster. And if you look at it as a Caribbean disaster, we see it is taking place in the countries populated by people of African descent.
Yeah.
Right across the region at one level. And the other interesting thing that comes out, I think, of looking at this as a regional disaster is an understanding of the extent of colonialism still in this region, even after decades old UN declarations against colonialism.
Yeah.
You spoke a bit earlier about the lifting of the Jones Act, and clearly what we're seeing here is just the suspension of one of the vestiges of colonialism that exists between the United States and Puerto Rico, regardless of the citizenship issue. There are many, many other issues that I'm sure you're more familiar with than I am that need to be discussed and looked at in that relationship also.
Going
straight to Puerto Rico, I think we in this British, English-speaking Caribbean, and the Anglophones, the Guadeloupes and Martiniques right next to, right among us, have an opportunity also to look at the instruments we now have for regional cooperation. And clearly to understand that our survival will come from deepening those, you know, across language barriers.
Well, Darbreen, what you say, urgency. what you're saying is so vital, and we are out of time, so we're going to have to go on to Trump's tax plan next. But you know what? We're going to continue this conversation, Dobrin. It's such an important one, and I really am doing my best to have our listeners understand the depth and the devastation of thousands of people in the region. So we appreciate your work, and we'll have you back so we could continue this discussion. Thank you.
Margaret, thanks.
Okay, Dobrin Omar, they're based in Antigua. We're just going to take a really short station break. We ran a little long on that last segment. And when we return, Josh Bivens will join us on Trump's tax plan. Stay with us. We'll be right back. No woman a cry. No woman a cry. No woman a cry. No woman a cry. Cause I remember when we used to sit in a government yard and trench. The late, great Bob Marley, No Woman, No Cry. Well, there's a lot of crying going on now in the Caribbean region, as well as in Mexico. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning, from 90 days after that, you can go to the KPFK website, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And we encourage you to subscribe for a free podcast. We'd also like to welcome our sound SoundCloud listeners, and today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Caribbean region. You can go to SoundCloud, just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And you can also check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member, Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook. Josh Bivens is waiting to break down this new plan with us. The framework for the GOP tax plan that Donald Trump has been teasing for months was finally released on Wednesday. Trump alleged to the press, quote, "The rich will not be gaining at all with this plan." But now, as the plan is unveiled, it's clear that the rich will become richer. These moves have already drawn criticism from Democrats. Chuck Schumer called the plan wealth fair, a play on welfare, and Bernie Sanders called it morally repugnant and bad economic policy. Now, here to break all of this down, I'd like to welcome Josh Bivens. He is the director of research at the Economic Policy Institute. His research includes macroeconomics, fiscal and monetary policy, the economics of globalization, social insurance, and public investment. He's the author of Failure by Design, The Story Behind America's Broken Economy, and Everybody Wins Except for Most of Us, What Economics Really Teaches About Globalization. Dr. Josh Bivens, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what's in this plan, you know, that should, you know, we should know about it, should also concern us?
Yeah, so before I get into sort of the menu of it, I would say that the characterization of this plan as providing really large tax cuts for the richest households and providing shockingly little for sort of the broad middle class, I think, is what you want to keep in mind. Basically, the top 1% of households are going to get about 50% of the total tax cuts in this.
Wow.
They're going to get about $150,000 a year in tax cuts on average. And so this is incredibly tilted toward the top, much more tilted even than the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003. And the bottom 35% of households in the United States, I don't see how they get a single thing from this. And in fact, some of them will actually see a small tax increase. And so this is actually, in the degree to which it makes sure no benefits at all go to working class families, that's the surprising part about this. I expected the tax cut for the very rich. That's pretty standard play. How stingy it is to sort of the broad middle class is the surprising thing.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is the cost of this in terms of revenue now coming into the government. I mean, you know, people complain about taxes, but they do pay for things like, you know, services and safety nets and public schools and that sort of thing. So given the cost of it, what is it? Something like $3 trillion or close to $3 trillion over a decade. So do we have any idea where that money is to come from?
No, we do not. There's, you know, the two obvious places in theory it could come from is they raise taxes somewhere else. And given that they're giving tax cuts to the highest income households, one imagines that the tax increases would have to fall outside that group. Or there's going to be a lot of pressure on spending, as you know. And we see that. At the same time, you know, almost in the same week that this plan is rolled out, we're just seeing the death of the Cassidy-Graham health care bill, which cut it would have added up hundreds of billions, not quite trillions, hundreds of billions from Medicaid over the next 10 years. And so I think that is the essential vision on the Republican side of the aisle. We want to clear out room to give huge tax cuts to the top by cutting programs like Medicaid. There were proposals to cut Social Security earlier this year in the Trump budget. It's very easy to see what their vision looks like, tax cuts for the rich and cuts in spending on programs that are really vital to everybody else.
So you mean somebody, the Trump, was lying again when he's talking about this is a huge middle class tax cut? Because from what you're saying, it's a huge tax cut for the 1%.
Yeah, I mean, that's a flat-out untruth. Whether it was an intentional lie or just ignorance, who knows? But this plan absolutely delivers huge tax cuts to the top 1%, and it's incredibly stingy, providing essentially no benefit at all for the bottom third. And even for people sort of you look at a family, married couple with one child who makes the exact median income, like the income right in the middle of the distribution, they would see a tax cut of less than one half of 1% of their income tax. At the same time, we're giving $150,000 a year on average to the top 1%. So I don't see how anyone could call this a middle class tax cut.
Yeah. And what about the punishing, what some people are calling the punishing of blue states like New York, like California, I think, where people are actually able to claim deductions for the state taxes that are being paid. What's in this plan now that affects that?
Yeah, so the pretty much one of the few provisions in the plan that actually on net raises some revenue is they do away with the state and local deduction, which means the taxes you pay on state income taxes or state sales taxes, you can deduct those from your income when you pay your federal income tax bill. Doing away with that deduction means everybody faces a higher tax bill because they no longer, not everybody, but people who itemize those deductions face a higher tax bill because they no longer can deduct them. And it has a very clear pattern in that blue states tend to have higher state and local taxes because they provide more services. They spend more on education. They have more generous Medicaid and unemployment insurance programs. And so this is one of the few things in the bill that provides a tax increase. And the cynic in me says it's no real accident that this tax increase sort of focuses like a laser on blue states instead of red states.
Yeah. And some of the people behind this plan, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary of fame of flying around on private jets, and his wife in expensive clothing and insulting, you know, a housewife because of what she was wearing. National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Orrin Hatch, Paul Ryan, Kevin Brady from the House Ways and Means. So, you know, I know you analyze the economics of this, but looking at this politically, do you have a view? I mean, Trump clearly needs a win, right, after the debacle with welfare, with the health care. Repeal and replace Obamacare that didn't go anywhere. So they're going to be pushing really hard on this. And the thing is that will this get through? Because people, they hear, oh, tax cuts, and not paying attention to the detail, you know, is he going to really be able to get away with this one?
It's a good question. I mean, normally, so tax cuts aimed at the rich is a very standard Republican thing. So one imagines the Republican caucus in Congress is going to be very united on this and try to push it through. I would say they have made it harder for themselves than I expected, in that like the playbook for the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 3 was they gave huge tax cuts to the top, but they actually did give non-trivial tax cuts to sort of working class families. Like they introduced the 10% tax bracket down from 15. You know, most of the money went to the top, but people got, you know, hundreds of dollars or a bit more from that Bush tax cut, and so they really felt like they were getting something. This plan is so stingy, sort of at for the bottom 50% of families, that there's no sort of sweetener like that at all. And then the other issue is you might have a couple Republicans who actually take their rhetoric about federal budget deficits seriously. And this is a bill that adds somewhere between $2.5 to $3 trillion to the debt over the next 10 years with no obvious means of paying for it. And so who knows? They might get some defection on that front. And then if they bundle it with another attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which there's been some talk of, that could make it more complicated as well. So normally I would think a tax cut for Republicans is an absolute easy slam dunk when they have the majority. They seem set on erecting some obstacles for themselves. And so, you know, in my view, hopefully, maybe they stumble over some of those.
Right. So I suppose for his working class base, white working class base, that they can only hope that some of this wealth from the 1% increased wealth will trickle down to them. And I say good luck with that one. But as more we know, learn more about this plan and we get more details, we hope to be able to have you back. And we really appreciate you being able to break this down for us. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and of course, Kiana. I always say Turner Williams, your Turner Williams, Kiana, our engineer for today's show. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.